and welcome to Monaco's food and drink show, The Menu. I am Markus Hippi. In the next 30 minutes, Nigella Lawson and what she thinks of the way people eat today.
For me, what's so interesting about cooking is the evolution of a recipe and how different cultures feed into one another.
Then, truffle hunting in Australia.
Damien's taken me on a drive in his rattling four-wheel drive up a hill to one of his trufferies, a thicket of oak and hazelnut trees, where he and his Jack Russell Frisbee are hunting for some black potatoes.
And Magnus Nilsson's mission to document the Nordic food culture.
I believe that if you have a stocked pantry of good ferments, you will be able to cook on a daily basis much faster and much better and more delicious and sometimes even more healthy than if you don't have them.
On top of that, we'll hear top tips for fermentation from Noma Restaurant and get a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. All that on this week's edition of The Menu here on Monaco 24. We start today with one of the most recognizable voices in the world of food and drink. British food writer, author and broadcaster Nigella Lawson has been celebrating 20 years since the release of her debut cookbook How to Eat. Released in 1998, it became a huge international hit and sold hundreds of thousands of copies in the UK alone. Since then, Nigella has written a number of other cookery books, hosted television shows, and even launched her own cookware range. She joined me at Midori House Studio One in October to discuss her career and what she now thinks about the way we eat. But first, Nigella recalled the release of How to Eat and whether she had any idea how successful the book would become.
I had no idea. Absolutely no idea. I mean, I was still slightly surprised by the fact that I'd written it. And I think I regarded it, in a way, as quite a very personal book. And so I don't think I could see beyond that. But I think it's probably harmful anyway when you write to think of a readership, because I think that can be quite corrupting. I was writing for myself, I was writing for my friends, I suppose, and to some extent, and as I explained, my mother and one of my sisters had died quite recently. My mother less recently. She died, you know, really quite young, and my sister had died in December 93. And I think part of the impetus for writing the book was really remembering not only their food, our food, I should say, but the conversations we always had. And I think for me, it was very much a way of continuing that conversation. And so I never really thought about it in terms of even other people noticing it or reading it. It's funny to say that. But even now when I write, I think it's so important not to think of readers, audience. Then you start becoming one of those people who starts thinking, what should I be doing? What's new? What's fresh? And I think really you just have to follow your own instincts.
How do you avoid thinking about the audience?
Because
you are writing something, you get the feeling, okay, someone's going to be reading this. How do you get away from that thought?
Because I think of a reader or a person in a more intimate way. I think of someone in a kitchen cooking or reading. And what I want to say, I suppose I started off as a journalist and not incidentally a food journalist, but I have a need to communicate and to share what I think. I'm one of those people that if I've read a book I liked, I sort of badger people with it. If I'm eating some food I like, I'll stick a fork in someone's face until they have to eat some. And I suppose so when I'm writing, yes, I'm thinking of a person, but I'm not thinking of a crowd of people. I'm probably thinking of some person I'm having the conversation with. Maybe someone who's anxious about cooking, maybe someone who I'm just trying to convey why I love this particular food, why I think this, and somehow to take away the rest of the noise around food.
How do you feel about your debut cookbook now, 20 years later? Have your cooking principles, for example, changed?
My cooking principles haven't. Obviously, there are certain things I feel differently about. I think, in a way, it's a very innocent book. Anything you do for the first time is, because you don't know how people are going to think about it. As I say, I wasn't even conscious of having any such thought. I think there's an urgency to my appeals to people about how they should do, what they should do. And although I still feel that, I suppose I temper it slightly more now. And I certainly, well, I suppose the real difference is if you write a book, your first book is really everything you've thought about food up till that point. It's a long time of eating and thinking about food that went into that book. I don't think I've changed at all. I think I still feel, and it's extraordinary, actually, there are ingredients, if we take it away from approach towards food and just what I was cooking, yes, a lot of the food is now quite old-fashioned, but some of it is old-fashioned in a way that then was no one cooked. And, for example, I lamented in How to Eat that kale was unfashionable. I mean, now you can't go to anywhere without there being kale everywhere. I also feel there are certain ingredients, miso, pomegranate seeds on food, tahini. There were certain ingredients that I was interested in that have since become much more prominent. Yes, I've changed my mind about certain things. I had enthusiasms for certain particular ingredients that maybe I don't always have. But my view about home cooking and its importance, and in a way the need not to be too bound up with perfectionism, I feel very intensely still.
And that book can be seen as quite a powerful statement as well, and I think you've changed the world, or changed the UK, at least when you look at how people eat nowadays and how people see food nowadays. When you look around, do you think that, wow, I actually did that, I actually changed the world this much?
Oh no, I don't think so. I think change comes from so many different areas and everything feeds in to something else. In my more megalomaniac moments, I might think, I did that. But then afterwards, I think, well, you know what? I didn't actually. It was just someone saying to me, this is good. You know, an Egyptian friend showing me about the tahina. I called it tahina then because that's what he calls it, a tahina sauce he did with lamb. And now it is more everywhere. But actually, to be honest, it was everywhere where he came from before. So it's really pilfering and generally stealing, borrowing. I always credited where things came from, and I think that's important. I feel that if you strive for novelty, which a lot of chefs do, and I'm not a chef, when the waiter says, the chef today has done, you know, lobster with pears and vanilla, and you just think, and why? You know, it hasn't been done before. Great. And I think that when we cook at home, I think we strive for originality less, but we get new ideas and new enthusiasms. But I always like to say where I've come across a particular pairing or an ingredient or a recipe, I don't think you should ever claim to have an idea that isn't yours. And actually one gets ideas from other sources. And I think it's interesting to find out.
That was Nigella Lawson, and you can find the full interview on the Menu Archive at monocle.com or iTunes. Let's continue with a Danish voice next, considered by many the best restaurant in the world. At Noma in Copenhagen, pretty much every dish contains some form of fermentation. As a matter of fact, the place even has its own fermentation lab for experimentation and innovation. Now René Redzepi and his colleague David Silber have released a book that sheds light on their clever approach to cooking. It's aptly called The Noma Guide to Fermentation, and I spoke to the authors a bit earlier this year. First, it was René Redzepi who began by explaining how ferments came to have such an important role in the Noma menus.
We opened 15 years ago in search of ingredients to put into our new idea of opening a restaurant in the Nordics with predominantly local foods and local ingredients. And in this search for ingredients, we stumble upon our own culture and our own history. And we realize, wow, we actually live in a cold climate region. People used to have to preserve the food to survive the cold winters. And one of the ways they did so was through fermenting of foods, particularly fermenting of meats and fermenting of fish. That was very common. And then as we sort of stumble into that, we start delving into it, and we start reading about it, researching, traveling the world. We discovered that there's a fermentation culture that spans the world, and in some places it's very active and alive and incredibly sophisticated. A place to note is a place like Japan, where their misos and soy sauces are just mind-boggling. And we started to learn from that, and slowly but surely it became that thing that gave Noma its flavor, but nobody could see.
What is it about ferments you like so much? What are the benefits of using them?
Fermentations are like building blocks. It's like when you build a house, you need a foundation. If you don't have a foundation, everything's going to crumble. And so the foundation in our cooking is all the ferments that we have. So a way for the listener to somehow maybe understand a bit better what fermentations can do for your cooking is when you have sushi. That's an easy one. We all have it. And it's okay. But as soon as you dip it in your soy sauce, or the chef puts that soy sauce, that's when the extra magic happens. And that's what we do. That's why we do it, to bring that extra little thing. We created many, many hundreds of things, but we probably have a good 100 different potions, liquids, pastes that we use throughout our cooking. All of them different, all of them quite unique. And they all add that little extra thing. And you can't see it most of the time. You probably won't be able to taste it unless it's not there.
Is it also quite convenient to have something like that that brings more taste to the food in a way?
It makes cooking easier. I mean, absolutely. Sometimes we have some of the most simplest things that we serve and people are like, you know, that's very simple. But in reality, there might be 7 drops of 4 different things on that took 6 months each and 5 years to develop. And, you know, through that hardship of work, you're able to then suddenly cook easier, if you will.
David, you are in charge of Noma's Fermentation Lab. What exactly happens there?
The Fermentation Lab is this entity, this kitchen or department that Renee really thought was essential. It wasn't enough for us to pardon my French, like half-ass these things. And when fermentation started, even before I arrived at Noma almost 5 years ago now, while we did it in a very romantic way. And even, you know, 4.5 years ago when I began, you would see bags of things exploding in the staff canteen or in the attic in our dry storage leaking all over the place. And while it worked, you know, we'd always knew that we could do it better. In the summer of 2014, the first version of the fermentation lab was built out of shipping containers in the parking lot behind the old Noma on the harbor of Copenhagen. And that was really where it kind of grew to the next level. When I began in there, when I started, when I moved from the kitchen into the fermentation lab, this was a place where we had a team, where we had a scientist and clever cooks, myself included, that would kind of push these things forward. So we were tasked with producing all of these products for the restaurant in environmentally controlled chambers where the humidity was just right, where the temperature didn't fluctuate too much, and then also tasked with just pure research. You know, in advance of going to Noma, Australia, you know, Renee was like, we should figure out how Vegemite is made, because that's something we should take with us. And so you look through the lens of science to understand these things and make them make sense where we are. And since we reopened Noma in its new space, as Noma 2.0, as it's lovingly called, the fermentation lab has kind of also been born again in a new facility that's so well-equipped, so well-designed, and everything just works so smoothly. And we still kind of carry that torch to this day. So we're producing more ferments than ever in 10 different temperature-controlled rooms. And we have a great team of myself and 3 other cooks that continue the R&D.
And what kind of experiments do you make over there? What kind of discoveries have you made? What happens there?
Sometimes discoveries are finding out that things don't work, or kind of, you know, beating them to death until you really kind of surrender.
Can you give me examples?
Yeah, I mean, just a really long, ongoing project that we're doing just this past week. You know, it's the height of game season at the restaurant right now. We're plucking a lot of ducks, and there's a lot of leftover feathers. We're trying to figure out how to make feathers edible. And there are bacteria out there that produce enzymes that can break down the keratin in feathers. And that's a test that we're running right now. So far, not so good, but we're not giving up just yet. So we literally knock on the door of scientists that kind of harness these enzymes. We get the pure samples and we just try and figure it out for ourselves.
That's amazing. What do you think have been your greatest achievements so far in the lab?
A personal favorite of mine that's also a personal favorite of Renee's is chicken wing garum. And that's something that I just kind of thought up one morning in the shower and I was like, you know what, why don't we try this? And for that, I mean, it's included in the book as well. It's one of the recipes in the garum chapter. Garums are relatives of fish sauces that you might come across in Thailand or Vietnam. We make one out of roasted chicken wings that's packed with umami, packed with roasted caramelized flavors, and is good on just about anything. So that's one I'm particularly proud of.
René Recepi and David Zilber from Copenhagen's Noma restaurant there. They are the authors of the book, The Noma Guide to Fermentation. You are with the menu on Monocle 24. Now, do you know which countries produce the most truffles each year? It might come as a surprise, but it's not France. It's not even Italy. Spain is at the top of the list, but number two isn't even in Europe. It's Australia. It's been less than 20 years since the first Australian truffle was harvested in Tasmania, and over the past 5 years in particular, the industry has boomed. Some of the best truffles are coming out of the districts around Canberra, the national capital about 3 hours' drive inland from Sydney. Its cold, dry winters are perfect conditions to grow the pungent tuber, and it is doing so well that Australian truffle farmers are selling their produce back to Europe, France, Italy, and yes, even the odd container going to Spain. Monocle correspondent Artie Bettikerry braved the cold winds to spend a day truffle hunting.
It's been described as black gold, and it's also been described as black potatoes.
Damien Robinson's farm is mostly about cattle, but he's had a sideline business in truffles called Turala Truffles for more than a decade, and it's become increasingly popular and profitable.
It makes good money, though, there's no doubt about it. You've got to have your wits about you, though, because it's a very fast-moving industry and the prices shift around and it's a very short season and you've got to be prepared to swing with the punches and stuff as far as what happens with the pricing. Sometimes you hold your ground a bit, you can make more money, but sometimes, you know, you can lose money.
Is it a really volatile market?
It is, actually. It's becoming more so. A few years ago, they were a lot rarer in Australia, so you could demand a pretty high price, and now there's a lot of young truffle farms coming on, and you suddenly get a crop that is, you know, bigger than you can deal with the local chef or whatever. You've got to find a market, and you've got to find it real quick, because the things go rotten in the fridge pretty fast.
Damien's taken me on a drive in his rattling four-wheel drive up a hill to one of his trufferies, a thicket of oak and hazelnut trees, where he and his Jack Russell Frisbee are hunting for some black potatoes.
Pick his way through the thistles. Fine truffle. See how he's turned there? He's found one. He's onto it. He's just got to show me where it is. Show me. Where is it? Okay. Good boy. Did you just notice that? Once he's on a centre speed up, head drops down and he turns away from his path. So there's sort of a body language with him, which, I mean, maybe I'm the only one can see it, but having said that, I'm not smelling the truffle frizz. Where is it? Yeah, it is. He's found another one. You can see it actually poking its head out of the soil there. So you'll see the sound of a truffle. A rock sounds like this, and if it's a truffle, it's going to sound like this. So it's a much duller thud. But in this gravelly soil, it's kind of nice to be able to tell the difference. There it is.
I think that's the biggest one yet today.
So you can see this soil being quite gravelly, the truffles are a bit knobbly, which does affect the price. Lovely. Let's have a look what we got here. Bloody knees have had it. This. Oh, there it is. You can see that truffle's quite high. Good boy.
How many would you get in a week?
We're pulling about 10 kilos a week at the moment. Maybe we'll probably slow down this week, I'm thinking. Last week we pulled about that, which is a pretty good yield for, you know, it's a bit hard to know what's coming as far as each week. This is, you know, I was talking to you about how it can be difficult to sell these things if you haven't got a market set up.
That's a big one.
Beautiful. Lovely truffle.
It looks like a potato.
It does look like a black potato, doesn't it? Fortunately, those discerning foodies know the difference. Just checking. And I think there's another one here. You get a feel when you've done this for a bit about the way the what's happening in the ground. You can see the soil moves around a bit. Yeah, no, I think we'll leave that. So, a lot of gravel in the soil. You can see makes it very difficult to dig. This particular truffery is a very difficult truffery for my hands and and you know, general well-being. It's annoying, but the rewards are good. And it's nice when you get a nice big truffle like that. Okay, we'll go to another try the next tree.
And how do Australian truffles taste?
They just taste exactly like the European ones. They're the same truffle, they're just growing in a difference. Like the cold climates around Canberra, being, you know, like the minus fives we get pretty much for 2 months of the year, they are very conducive to maturing the truffle, so you get that very deep, rich smell. Other places in Australia that don't get those sort of frosts, the truffles don't smell as good. It's the same truffle, it's just, you know, the nature of the cold area that we're in now. I mean, you know, there's some places in Australia where they have an avocado farm next to a truffle farm. You know, this is like, well, that's great, but those truffles are never going to be great truffles because it's just not cold enough. I mean, avocado's a tropical fruit.
That was Australian truffle farmer Damien Robinson speaking with Monocle's Artie Bettigerry. And finally today we meet Magnus Nilsson, who runs one of the world's most famous restaurants, Feviken, in the Swedish countryside. Besides looking after the international customers at his farm restaurant, Magnus has spent the last 6 years with a massive project of documenting the Nordic food culture in the form of two extensive books, the Nordic Cookbook, which was released back in 2015, and the new Nordic Baking Book, released earlier this year, which has an astonishing number of recipes from across the Nordic region. Back in October, I met Magnus to talk about why he decided to write this book.
For me, this book, the Nordic Baking Book, is the end of a six-year research project. And most people today will see this as a separate book and a separate thing, but the fact is that it's just the conclusion of all that work. And
you did release the Nordic Cookbook
exactly,
some years ago.
Which was halfway through the work, 3 years into the research work, and then this is sort of the bread and baking bit that concludes it. And for me, I mean, the main motivation with the whole project, both the Nordic Cookbook and the Nordic Baking Book, is to really explain what Nordic food culture looks like. Because I think that Nordic food culture is mostly very misunderstood, even within the Nordic region, actually. And I mean, if you type into Google Nordic cooking, you'll get a couple of hundred articles about very ambitious modern restaurants like Faviken or Noma or Francin or Maemo and, you know, a handful of others. And then you'll get some recipes for gravlax and some for herrings and some for some buns, perhaps. And then lots of images from IKEA. And that's it, you know, and that's not how we eat.
No, it's not. Do I understand correctly that you actually want to make people understand the variety of what's going on and what people eat at home?
I do. And I wanted, you know, I wanted these books to be a snapshot of what it looks like now, with some historical context, of course, but mostly what people cook today.
I have to say that one of the things I loved about this book was that you actually have a contemporary view into what people eat. There's actually a section about Nordic pizza.
Which all the Italians hate, you know. But I think it's like food culture is not static and it's not something that we can decide what it is. Food culture is just a product of what we cook. And if people eat pizza in a country, it will become part of their own food culture after not that long, you know.
Do you want to explain what Nordic pizza is like? That's something you don't actually get from fine dining restaurants abroad when you go to look for something Nordic.
No. Nordic pizza, generally speaking, from a Swedish standpoint at least, is always thin crust. And what makes it unique is that, I mean, it came to the country with Italian immigrants in the 60s, and it was popularized. And in the last 30 years now, every new generations of sort of immigrants from anywhere in the world, really, war refugees and work immigrants, etc., who come to Sweden, for some reason, they've started pizzerias. Or they bought pizzerias. You know, I think that it's because it's a low entry threshold to the workers market, essentially.
It's often quite hard to find jobs over there, so it's maybe easier to launch a business.
I think so. And it's, you know, easy enough to start a place like that. And what's fascinating is that each generation have added something of their own culture into the pizza. So, I mean, in Sweden, for example, it's unthinkable to have pizza without cabbage salad on the side coming from the Balkans. You know, you can have a kebab pizza that was probably introduced with Turkish immigration, You know? And it goes on like that. And I think that it's very multi-layered and it's completely fascinating.
How different are the Nordic countries from each other if you look at their baking traditions?
The Nordic region is, geographically speaking, such a vast region. I mean, from Finland to Greenland, it covers an area that's much bigger than the whole rest of Europe. And naturally, you'll have a lot of climatic variation as well, meaning lots of different products. So already there, you have a lot of diversity. And then culturally speaking, I mean, you can roughly divide the Nordic region into two, one western and one eastern part. The western part being mainly Danish influenced and the eastern part being mainly Swedish influenced. And that has to do with who occupied whom and things like that. And then we have Finland, I mean, your home country, that also has the sort of Euro-Hungarian, Central European or Eastern European influence, which is, you know, sets it completely apart from the rest as well.
What kind of a project was it for you to create this book and its predecessor, the Nordic Cookbook, considering that we're talking about a vast area? How do you find out about all these local dishes, local recipes, local traditions?
Lots of traveling. Lots and lots of traveling. But also, I mean, I made sure that I had at least one person in each country or region or culture who was very knowledgeable on, you know, that particular part of the region, to help me find the most relevant stuff and to also help me to maintain a balance in the recipe index. Because the point of the book is to represent as big a part of the region as possibly, as well as possible. And that's not easy to do as an outsider.
I think it's also interesting, looking at the Nordic region, it's really varied language-wise as well. I would imagine that it was easy for you to deal with Norwegians, deal with Danes, maybe Icelandics as well. But Finland has a different language, yeah, totally.
Absolutely. And there, I mean, I worked with Kenneth Nas, who's a friend of mine, food journalist. He lives in Helsinki and he's Swedish-speaking Finn, but he also speaks Finnish and he has a passion and a love for all of the Finnish food culture. And I mean, if it wasn't for him, it would have been impossible for me as a person not speaking Finnish to actually produce any research in Finland.
Magnus Nilsson of Sweden's Sveviken restaurant there. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. For previous episodes of this program, go to Monocle's website, SoundCloud or iTunes. And remember to subscribe to the show so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do check out our Menu spin-off Food Neighborhoods. It's a special podcast that takes you to some of the world's most interesting culinary districts, and it premieres every Tuesday. This show was edited and mixed by Kieran Banerjee, and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. This is Found What I've Been Looking For by Tom Grennan. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year.
Fine lines between us, they say nowadays don't mean much, cause an anchor in the sand. What we did, but my ship set sail, and I'm here to tell the eyes.